Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your drop D of music news and metal phenomenology. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. You're hearing "O Father, O Satan, O Son" by the Polish band Behemoth. And talking about metal today on the show is Michael Robbins. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Michael is a poet. He's the author of the book Alien vs. Predator, and he's also a metal commentator. You wrote a really interesting piece in Harper's just this past May called "Destroy Your Safe and Happy Lives, A Poet's Guide to Metal."
I did.
So tell us a little bit about the connection that you established in this piece between poetry and metal.
Well, I sort of traced the lineage of Romanticism in both seeing poetry and metal as different kinds of answers to similar problems, similar questions about living in a world of uncertainty and coming to terms with it.
Negative capability.
Right.
Is the metal way.
Right. Yeah, there's a kind of embrace of the primordial, the dark, the stuff that you're supposed to look away from. And in both romantic poetry and in metal, there's a sort of willed attention to what is unsavory, uncanny, and not for its own sake, right, but in order to arrive at some deeper understanding and in order to, I quote Rilke saying, to reevaluate and change your life, you know?
Yeah.
You must change your life.
Yeah.
Which I end up saying no one actually does, but that's what art is for.
Yeah. And at the beginning of your essay, you quote a William Blake poem.
Yeah.
And it says, "All that can be annihilated must be annihilated." And it says, "There is a negation and there is a contrary. The negation must be destroyed to redeem the contraries." Certain words and phrases there resonate for people who listen to metal.
Sure.
Think about all the metal songs with the word annihilate or annihilation in them.
Or just all the band's names that are based on some form of negation. You know, Nihility and what is the band I'm thinking of? Hate Eternal. You know,
just
there's a great no. Punk says no too, but punk says no in a kind of like, heck no, we're not going to take this. You know, we're going to rise up and, you know, metal just says no.
And it says, it has always been so.
Right. Right. It says, unlike punk, it says there's no real, nothing good is going to come of our saying no.
Yeah. There's no rising and falling. It's just all, it's in a way, it's the most cynical outlook, but there's also great possibility in there. No? And great, how would you put it? It's not exactly hope, but it's like excitement, hysteria.
Mm-hmm. Hysteria, Def Leppard.
Exactly. We could do this all day. No, but I mean it's something powerful.
Sure.
Something powerful comes out of all
power,
that negation.
You know, power has a lot to do with it. I mean, I find a lot of affinities in the article, in the essay, between punk and metal and poetry. And one of them is that they're ways of channeling power, empowerment, except that in metal the power is not wholesome. It's not uplifting, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very empowering, but it's empowering in a much darker sense than in the other two.
But it's also something that can bring people together.
Oh, yeah.
And create a scene, just like any popular art.
Right.
Just like any art. You know, you find other people who are kind of attracted by those same frequencies, and all of a sudden you've got a community.
Metal wouldn't work without the communal aspect.
Exactly, yeah.
It's tragic to think of this energy being channeled into only by the self.
Sure.
To be just some kid whose despair is eating away at him. And one hopes that he does find others with whom he can celebrate in this way just how – this is the New York Times, so I can't say the word I want to say – just how gosh darn bad everything is.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, now this is no longer the age of Metallica.
No.
Or of Led Zeppelin or of enormous worldwide – metal audiences and, you know, top 10 metal records. Now this is a small audience music.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concept that just has endless potential. It will keep going past the end of the world.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel like jazz, I mean, I know you'll disagree with me, but I feel like jazz has stopped being exciting in many ways, or it's exciting in a niche way. Whereas, and you know, one could argue that the same is happening to hip hop, is being transformed in a way. It's not becoming a niche product, but it's being diluted into other musical forms. It's becoming part of R&B or something like that. These are all generalizations, but metal is very interesting to me because it's still just completely alive and splintering in a million different directions all the time and doing these new things, you know?
Well, you're right. I don't agree with you.
That's fine.
About the other things you said. But what I was getting to is that there's no metal band that has a radio hit that we're all jamming out to.
No.
You know, there's no Pharrell of metal. We all hear the same song three times a day. But you go to metal shows or festivals, or you sort of commune with a few other people around a record. And I feel that metal keeps pushing you toward questions of ritual.
Yeah.
We're doing this for a reason. Why are we doing this? Why are we creating all this energy and heat around this weird record or this weird band?
Yeah, I think there's a ritualistic aspect to it that is often actually troped in metal itself, you know. So you get something like the band Ghost, who now are known in this country as Ghost BC, some copyright issue, where there's a ritualistic aspect to their shows in a literal sense, where they mimic the Catholic rites, you know. Mm-hmm. They dress up as these skeleton popes or whatever. And I don't think that's just, you know, sort of cartoon blasphemy, but it's a way of emphasizing the communal aspects of the music itself. You know, you don't just listen to metal. You listen to metal and you wear the t-shirts and you go to the shows and you argue about it and you sing along. I saw Converge in Chicago last year or the year before. They're kind of a hardcore-ish band, but they're often associated with metal. I was amazed how many people were singing along with every word and like very loudly, like, you know, singing along with each other, very consciously being part of the shouting of the lyrics. Partly because I could never I didn't know you could understand the lyrics to Converge songs. I've never understood them. So there were people who had memorized them. Mm-hmm. And this was very interesting to me. The lyrics are bad, but people found that singing along with Jacob Bannon was part of the show, you know, not just like the part where you just are singing along to a song, but everyone is singing along together in a way that reminded me of something like, you know, the singing. I mean, this is going to sound strange, but it did remind me of something like the singing of hymns in church. You know, everyone is participating. The voices are raised together.
Sure. We were just saying that, you know, there is no big thing called metal.
No.
People
disagree about what it is.
Well, they do. Yes. And then they gravitate toward certain subsections of it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned in your piece that you came to metal kind of late, which is fine. Many of us do. It only makes sense to some of us once we reach a certain age.
Right. Well, it's so ridiculous that you have to stop taking yourself as seriously as many adolescents do. Certain intellectual pretensions of adolescence don't lend themselves to an unironic embrace of metal. Whereas punk, I think you can find more affiliations with the person you want to be when you're an adolescent of a certain type. But as you get older, I think you can stop feeling as though you're somehow better than the more ridiculous aspects of metal.
Well, maybe punk is more particular. You know, maybe punk is more a set of slogans,
mm-hmm.
Whereas metal is a disposition. And as you get older, what you feel is more just that overriding disposition.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. So it's almost a difference between position and disposition.
Nice way of putting it.
Oh, thank you.
What was your way in? What was the subcategory or subcategories
that
you felt good about when you started listening to metal?
There were two. There was thrash, which is punk-like enough that I could understand it musically.
Sure. You're talking about early Metallica.
Metallica.
Slayer, yeah.
Yeah. Not Anthrax. I didn't get into them, and I didn't get into what's the other of the big four, so-called? Megadeth?
Yeah, Megadeth.
Yeah, I did not get into either of them. I can't stand Dave Mustaine's screaming voice.
Yeah.
But Slayer and Metallica were easy in a way. The melody isn't as there as it is in punk, but I understood the ferocity, the energy of it. And then weirdly, because I had also been into people like Steve Reich and John Zorn and free jazz, I was able to get into drone metal.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I bought a couple records by Sun, mm-hmm. or as I like to call them, Sun O, ... Mm-hmm. You know, this was weird stuff, but I had a kind of, you know, avant-garde-y precedent for it. You're just playing a chord and just letting it resonate in like a cavern for an hour, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that the sound was like if molasses was really loud.
Yeah.
You know, and I found that attractive.
Well, and that's a music of space,
yes.
too. You know, it's a music that you situate yourself in, and also the music just travels a certain distance,
right.
you know?
It's a physical music, and
yeah.
it's physical in a different way from thrash, which is also physical. It's physical in a sort of like, okay, this is my body, mm-hmm. and I'm feeling my body. Actually, it reminded me a lot of when I was in my late 20s, I would listen to Pauline Oliveros, her experiments in deep listening, where
sure.
she would record
in
underground.
Cistern, yeah.
yeah, cistern. The idea was that the sound was somehow going to engage with your nervous system in such a way mm-hmm. that it would be like a transcendental experience. And, you know, I mean, I never bought that aspect of it, but it does seem to flip a switch in your head or something,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, it allows you to check in with yourself
right,
a little bit.
Right.
But Behemoth. I'm not sure whether Behemoth allows you to check in with yourself in the same way.
I know. It's not the same at all. Yeah. And so I had to – I mean, I think everybody explores different avenues, you know, once they've exhausted. I mean, metal – one thing about metal that I love is that it has so many different paths you can go down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Behemoth, I didn't really ever get into them. I didn't like the Apostasy as much as a lot of people did.
Behemoth is a Polish band
yeah.
that sings a lot about Satan.
They do sing. They like to sing about Satan, you know. Also, they like to sing about the Antichrist.
Yeah.
They have many topics, hell and the devil.
And you yourself have written about religion.
That's
one of your subjects as a writer.
Yeah. One of my unexpected hats, the hat of one who writes about religion. Kind of a popish hat, I suppose.
If anything about Behemoth draws you in, is there a connection between your interest in religion, having grown up within a certain religion, and then here you are confronted with a band that gets into trouble for Bible-tearing incidents?
Right. Yeah, there isn't, as far as I can tell, because I have never, even as a sort of hell-fearing kid... And, you know, I should be clear, I wasn't really raised in religion. My mother was religious, but I didn't live with her. And my father is a pretty staunch atheist. I just went to church on my own. Like, that was my own thing. And I stopped going in my teens, and I didn't really think about it much again until my 30s. Even as a kid, I saw absolutely no – I was able to see that the Satanism, the cartoonish Satanism of metal, wasn't about Satan. You know, I don't think Satan is a real – thing, and it's never bothered me. I've never felt any contradiction.
You just trust that most metal bands who are singing about Satan are using it as a kind of metaphor.
No, it's not even that I trust. I just, if they aren't, then they're stupider than I thought, you know, because mm-hmm. it's a silly aspect of metal, but it is one that I understand. I think now a lot of the troping of Satanism is simply a continuation of a sort of tradition. It's a kind of claiming of a heritage. If you're not singing
about...
A heritage
of heresy.
Yeah, a heretical heritage.
Yeah.
I think that's the name of Opeth's next record.
Yeah.
And with something I talk about in the article, there's a very long line of poetic thinking that tropes Satan as a kind of, kind of metaphor against orthodoxy, against repression, a way of affirming dark and creative energies. William Blake, who is certainly a Christian, you know, uses Satan in this way. John Milton's Paradise Lost is quite famously problematic in that Satan is a lot more attractive as a character than God,
mm-hmm.
who's profoundly boring in the play, whereas Satan is heroic and interesting. So yeah, I mean, if they're not doing that, if they think that there is some supernatural Satan out there whom they are worshiping or whatever, then that's – I don't know. I don't have a hard time believing people that these guys are that stupid, but perhaps it's true.
Well, I mean, there's certain things that a band can do purely out of a really healthy showbiz instinct.
Oh, sure.
As we were talking about before, I feel like the funny thing about metal is that it's like it has these two modes. One is the mode of it when it's far away or when you're just learning about it and it's like, whoa, do those guys really believe that stuff?
Right,
whoa.
Right.
And then it's the mode of you're in the room with the band. You're seeing the band. And it's like, oh, I get it. These guys,
yeah.
These guys know what they're doing. Like when you see Watain.
Right.
Watain.
I don't see Watain because I don't want to be covered in blood is the only thing.
And then the other thing they do is they shoot out the horrible smell.
Yeah, I don't want that.
The death smell.
Right. I'm not worried about the blasphemy. I'm worried about getting covered in blood and smelling that crap, you know?
The smell of the dead right. mouse in your apartment.
Right.
You
no.
have to suffer through that for a show. Anyway, like – That's no, good old
showbiz. It's like a Halloween haunted house.
Yeah.
You know? And they actually are the ones who claim. I interviewed Eric Danielson of the band's frontman for this article, and I didn't really put in the parts where he was being po-faced about it, but he is quite po-faced about it, you know? I don't know if it's an act. I suspect it is. It's an act that generates copy, right? Publicity for the band. But you go to a show like that. I haven't been to a Watain show, but I imagine it's so theatrical and so over the top that you have a hard time. Plus, I've heard that those guys are perfectly nice guys.
Everybody's
you know, Eric
nice.
Was Eric's very nice to me.
Sure.
You know, so I'm like, well, if you're really a Satanist, are you going to be so nice? I mean,
All right. So we came in hearing Behemoth, the song "O Father, O Satan, O Son" from the recent record called
"The Satanist."
The Satanist,
not just Satanist, but the Satanist.
The Satanist. Which came out recently.
Yeah, it came out 2 months ago, 3 months ago?
Yeah, February, I think.
4 months ago?
Yeah. Anyway, you can learn all about Nergal, the singer of Behemoth, because his memoir is soon to be translated from Polish, called Sacrum Profanum, The Confession of the Heretic.
I love it when they use Latin.
So let's move on to Paul Bearer. Let's hear a little bit of Paul Bearer from Portland, Oregon, the ghost that used to be. Okay, Michael Robbins, how would you describe Paul Bearer?
They have a reputation for being kind of a sludgy, doomy band.
Yeah,
you know, their first record, I think it was their first, Sorrow and Extinction. Really, you can get a sense of their themes from these records. The band is called Paul Bearer. Their first record is called Sorrow and Extinction. So they have a certain doomy mentality about them. So by doom and sludge, you know, the kind of a slow tempo. I don't know. You know more about music than I do. Technically, how do you characterize the chords that they use? These massive chords,
slow,
yeah,
big,
big, like a dinosaur.
Yeah.
You know. Although this one, as I recall, is a bit more up tempo than their usual stuff. Which is not to say it's a snappy number.
Mm-hmm.
It has a more anthemic quality. But yeah, they are not by any means, you know, droney. They play recognizable songs, but they're real heavy, thick, sleepy, kind of loud, crashing songs. Like, actually, I stopped taking notes on this record once I had written that it was like dead heroes rolling moons across the floor of a mausoleum because it was such a horrible metaphor that I decided not to trust my instincts.
You're talking about the Paul Bearer record that's coming out in August?
Foundations of Burden, I think it's called.
Yeah. The Ghost That Used to Be, which we just heard.
I think it's The Ghost That I Used to Be.
The Ghost That I Used to Be is the single.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first single.
Coming to the Hot 100 soon.
Let's be optimistic and say the first single.
The first single.
From the record.
Well, there's only like six songs on it, so they could potentially all be singles.
Yeah.
It could be like Thriller.
Doom metal is a whole other thing. You know, it descends from early Black Sabbath, et cetera, et cetera. But also there's a tradition within doom metal of sort of like a grandness in the singing.
Kind of almost operatic often. His vocals
This is about a third of the way to operatic.
Right. His vocals are certainly more vibrant than he's not screaming or growling as is common in death metal or black metal.
Right.
But no, they're not. He's not, you know, King Diamond or anything.
It's interesting with doom metal because I feel like the given is that the tempos are going to be slow, you know.
Right.
And within that is where you have to kind of work,
progression.
Work. You have to work the strange magic to make the music charismatic. The guy in Yob. Mike Scheidt.
I love Yob. They're also from Portland, aren't they?
They're from Oregon, somewhere in Oregon. Yeah. There's
something about in the woods up there.
There's something about what he does. Oh, there's some kind of rhythmic magic in what he does.
Well, you know, they're quite groovy at times.
What I'm getting at is that there is a possibility of being groovy within doom metal.
Yeah.
And my slight problem with Pallbearer is that there's not enough of that.
I had a similar reaction to the first record until I listened to it a number of times. They don't get groovy, you know. I think Sub Rosa from last year, Sub Rosa released a record which was like the doomy, sludgy record of the year. Mm. I thought it was a great record. And they get a little groovy, but what I see in Pallbearer is the doomy, sludgy aspect is actually masking a really kind of catchy band. There's a catchiness that is not a grooviness.
Yep.
These are, you know, music theory terms we're using now. Grooviness and catchiness.
All right.
They're catchy.
This isn't college.
No, it's not college. If it were, I find that I really am hearing kind of like what could be a 3-minute pop song stretched out to these. Maybe I'm just crazy, but this is, especially in this tune off their new record, the sort of vibrancy of the chords at the beginning. It's catchy. I find myself kind of like nodding along to it in a way.
Well, you know, in regular pop music, sometimes you find very bright and creative people who sort of smuggle weirdness into something that is generally bright and catchy and acceptable.
Sure.
With some metal bands, it's sort of like the other way around.
Right.
You know, like the bottom line is this is music for a cult and it is not to be understood quickly, and you know, you have to have a special password to be able to enjoy this. But actually, inside these bands is like a pop band,
right?
You know,
right? You're not going to mistake it for bubblegum. But you know, we were talking about how Behemoth and all three bands that we chose for today, they kind of have like a rocky quality. They're rocking out.
It happens to a lot of groups.
Yeah,
a lot of the best ones.
And I'm totally all for it. You know, I like. Last year, Kvelertak had an album that, and people were saying, well, it's not metal, it's just hard rock. And I thought, well, I guess I like hard rock then because it sounds pretty good to me. There's a catchiness to a lot of punk where you could basically have a Jan and Dean song or something that is just supercharged and it could be punk. But I find that metal, if you listen to it long enough, you start to see that it's a lot. It depends on a lot of the same kinds of progressions and manipulations of pop expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the way that both the tracks we've heard so far have a kind of just guitar rock quality to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good guitar bands.
And then the same can be said for the last thing we'll hear, which is Nux Vomica. This song, Choked at the Roots, so Nux Vomica. If I understand them correctly, they're sort of like a crust band with ambitions.
Well, you know who they remind me of in some respects is the band whose name I can't say on the air. It's I'll just say effed up, and if you want to bleep that out, you can. But something up.
The band from Toronto.
Yes, the hardcore band.
That had a record called The Chemistry of Common Life.
Great record.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's weird about—
Friends of the Popcast.
Yeah, they were interviewed here now. I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about them is that they take hardcore, which is supposed to be tight, fast, short, a flash grenade, and they stretch it out in a kind of proggy way.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that Nux Vomica do a similar thing. It's not as proggy. It's not as jammy. It's not jamming, you know, but there's a weird elongation of a basic template that I find really entrancing. This is my favorite record of the year so far.
Is it?
Yeah. And I love the way that this song begins. It reminds me a bit of Marquee Moon by Television, sort of classic punk, post-punk, also stretched out, you know, like that's like 8 minutes, this is like 10 or something. But there's the way that Marquee Moon starts with basic elements of just, you know, the guitar figure and then the bass and the drums come in on top of it and then the vocals come on top of it and it's all built up and then they strip it all down in reverse order and then there's then they build it all back up again. And there's a real sense of building in this song. And there's a number of passages in the song that it progresses from like a sort of suite or something to through these different punky permutations. And each one just is captivating to me. I think it works as a whole in a really interesting way.
So I feel like one of the interesting things about people who write well about metal, as you do, is that they tend to be interested in the parts of metal that seem to transcend the basics of metal. In other words, like there's a meat and potatoes of metal. Mm-hmm. There's a middle of the thing. Right. And then there are these examples that seem to create an outside, records or bands that are trying to, consciously or not, trying to sort of subvert the cliches,
right,
do what you're not expecting them to do, perhaps irritate the rank and file. I don't right. know. What do you think about all that?
I definitely love the meat and potatoes of metal, but I don't know that I have as much to say about it because it's the staple, you know. And coming to metal as I did somewhat late, I'm constantly learning that metal, you know, that metal's house has many more mansions than I thought. There's a sort of weird ecumenicism to metal that I hadn't expected as someone outside it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly it is cloistered in a way, and it's sort of standoffish about its boundaries. But those boundaries are expansive in a way that you don't really understand when you're outside it. So maybe I'm just drawn to the ways that it is willing to experiment with and refute its own identity, you know. It's confident enough, I guess, that it can encompass all of these different things. It's confident enough in its identity that it can let its identity blur.
Well, if it's so much of it is about refutation
right.
and negativity, might as well turn that on itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting that two of the bands that get covered a lot in Decibel, for instance, Decibel magazine, almost the only publication devoted to metal because the others are so much worse. It's a pretty good outlet. You know, they're constantly giving Converge and this other band that I mentioned from Toronto coverage in their magazine, and it's strange because neither of them is a metal band.
No.
And yet there's a sense in which they are metal bands given that so much else gets called metal. And I'm interested, you know, we were talking about Taylor Swift, who sort of straddles pop music and country music in a similar way. And I guess that these hybrids or these marginal figures are interesting because they indicate possibilities and a kind of fearlessness that is more creative than what you find in a genre that polices its boundaries so with such vigor. That's how genres stagnate. That's how, you know, you can still find online punk forums where they're defending true punk and
sure.
real punk, you know.
Sure.
And they're not going to let these, like, Against Me isn't punk.
Right.
That's a stultifying attitude, and it's not what music's about. So people want to say that metal albums that I like are not metal or that, you know, real metal is this or that or has these characteristics. You know, people wrote about the Harper's article that I said Led Zeppelin was a metal band. You know, and they have all these reasons why Led Zeppelin did not play heavy metal.
Sure.
I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in how possibilities that Led Zeppelin represented and the way they opened the path for an entirely new way of thinking about rock and roll.
One last subject I want to touch on is a band that also has a new album and recently gave a concert in New York that you and I were both at, which is I Hate God. This band from New Orleans has a new self-titled album, first record in, I forget what it is.
Like 11 years or something,
maybe even more,
yeah.
13, 14. And that band, to me, represents something really interesting, which is the possibility of a group based on very simple musical premises.
Yeah, they're kind of like the Ramones in that way.
That can get better.
Yes.
That has the possibility of getting better as they move through time, which I don't think the Ramones did that.
No, the Ramones were kind of perfect to start with. And then they got worse.
Slayer's another example of a group that, I mean, we could argue about this, but...
Well, Slayer got better.
I think they got better too. And sometimes I've seen them in the past 10 years, I've thought critics shouldn't use the word perfect.
Right.
But that's kind of what it was.
Yeah.
It was almost
they
perfect.
Were locked in.
Yeah. There's something about just pure dedication to a finite
right.
set of musical goals.
Right.
And maybe it's something about the metal attitude too. You know, maybe it's something about what I'm trying to get is, why does this not happen in punk?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it more likely to happen in metal?
There's more heroin in punk, for one thing. No, but
there was a little bit of heroin in I Hate God.
Yes, I shouldn't joke.
I understand.
Yeah, that's true. I don't have an answer to that question, but I suspect that the point we started with has something to do with it. The way that you said metal is a disposition and punk is a position. Punk is a young person's music. You can play it as an older person, of course, but it's always going to be about an initial adolescent rebellion. It's grown out of that. I don't mean that as a denigration. Adolescent rebellion is necessary. But metal is something you can grow into and that you can grow old with, you know? I don't remember the last time I listened to the first Clash record. I love it in the sense that I used to listen to it all the time and I loved it, but I don't listen to it anymore. But metal is, it's a much more anti-intellectual genre than punk. And I don't mean that, again, as a denigration. Critics are attracted to punk. Critics write books about punk, you know. They write books that quote Adorno. No one is really responding the same way to metal, so it doesn't have as many reasons not to just concentrate on the music.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I Hate God. And you know, those guys are in their 50s now, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And they sounded great. They've got the dumbest name of any band in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I Hate God is spelled EYE,
yeah.
Hate God, for some reason.
Yeah.
I mean, even just I, like the first person singular, Hate God, would be a better name for a band. There's no way for me to express my disdain for that name that is deep enough and profound enough. Oh, it's such a bad name. But they were good. They were tight. You know, it was weird. They had played those songs.
And loose, too.
Yeah, they were tight and loose in a kind of Moby Dicky way.
Mm-hmm.
Fast and loose. And whatever the guitarist's name is, he was on point that night. I haven't heard the new record, but I enjoyed the way that the new songs kept the formula without just making it seem stale, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Michael Robbins, thank you very much for visiting Popcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And let's hear Nux Vomica's Choked at the Roots. That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. You can read Michael Robbins's piece about metal, Destroy Your Safe and Happy Lives, A Poet's Guide to Metal, at harpers.org. It's behind a paywall, but worth it. You can read Michael Robbins' book of poetry, Alien vs. Predator, and his second book, to be published in September by Penguin, The Second Sex. Read our metal coverage, day in and day out, at nytimes.com/music. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. We thank you for listening.